Hey Blenders, on today's show we have Julie Taymor talking to us about The Glorias, news on a Lion King follow-up from director Barry Jenkins, and we discuss the Marvel Cinematic Universe shuffling its dates. This episode of Real Blend is brought to you by Plex. Plex is a streaming platform with thousands of free movies and TV shows with no subscription required. With Plex, you get access to a variety of great content that's easy to use on all of your screens, including films like Unstoppable, The Host, a great creature feature from Oscar winner Bong Joon-ho, Take Shelter, Black Dynamite, and more. But Plex isn't just movies, it's a one-stop media service that also features podcasts, music, over 100 free live TV channels, and a way to store and stream your own personal media. There are lots of choices these days when it comes to streaming media, but Plex offers something that no other streaming service does. All types of content in one place, viewable on any device you want. Go to plex.tv to learn more and sign up. Again, that's plex.tv. Hello, Blenders, and welcome to episode number 137 of Real Blend, a podcast that is neither light as a feather nor stiff as a board. My name is Sean O'Connell, the managing director here at Cinema Blend, and I am thrilled to invite you to another episode of our weekly movie podcast. On this week's show, insert big news, insert big movie, and insert guest.
You really got to do that to me right now.
I'm joined each week on the show by Kevin McCarthy of Fox 5 in Washington, D.C.
We're not even trying anymore.
Hi, Kev. How are you?
How are you doing, buddy?
I'm doing well. And also Jake Hamilton of Fox 22.
Insert name of co-host.
Insert name. It does say intro guys in bold. housekeeping for this week's episode. If you guys are watching us on the YouTube channel, first off, welcome to the visual aspect of the show. Arthur Mingo, who is a very dedicated listener of the show, is singling out Jake's reactions. So if you need a reason to watch us on the YouTube channel, Jake reacting to things that Kevin and I say is apparently
entertain
things like the fact that I will pay $60 for the Marvel movies.
I actually forget because even before we sort of switched over to doing this video format, we still always used video just to kind of make the conversations a little bit more intimate, to make them more lively. So it's not like we started really doing anything differently. We just started recording the video. So I kind of sometimes forget that my reactions to things are
recorded,
documented
for all time.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
So if you're watching us on the YouTube channel, first off, thank you. If you're listening to us on the audio stream, you can head over to YouTube and subscribe to our two channels, the Real Blend podcast on YouTube and Real Blend clips. One is the full show. One is segments that we pull out so that we can isolate and you guys can share them. Of course, we're available wherever you get your podcasts. And I want to plug the Real Blend store as well, too, where you can get merchandise for the show, T-shirts, mugs, tote bags, and some other really fun things. Yes, Gabe.
I just wanted to say while you're plugging the store,
yes,
to keep your eyes and ears peeled, because we might have, down the line, we might have some more stuff for you.
Like
something
what?
Cool.
Like seasonal merch?
Yeah, like I'm not going to say too much. We'll just say keep your eyes peeled.
Like a beanie?
Masks. We did do masks
Like Real Blend, like
oh, a
like
beanie mittens? Would be. Gabe is actually wearing a beanie right now.
I am.
One of those caps. He's not part of the... Oh, Daenerys. You know, we should have like dog collars and scarves for dogs. All of us have dogs. Okay. Why not?
I'll get right on that.
No? Jake, no?
Yeah.
What's the difference between a scarf for dog and scarf for human?
Well, they're bigger.
Smaller.
The human ones are bigger, is what I meant to say.
What if you're a little person with a big dog?
We're off the range here. Cinemablend.com /shop. Let's get right to the weekly poll. So in honor of the trial at the Chicago 7 opening, we asked you guys, what's your favorite Aaron Sorkin screenplay? I didn't want to put best. I wanted to isolate this for favorite. Jake, you are our resident Aaron Sorkin guy. I'm going to throw it to you. I gave them three choices, A Few Good Men, The Social Network, and Steve Jobs. I also gave them other. What do you think won for favorite Aaron Sorkin screenplay?
First of all, that's tough just because I know one of them has to be other. So that's tough that you had to pick three.
Yes.
I think Social Network had to have been the reigning champ.
That is correct. Let's go around the horn and talk which ones we would choose. Kev, of those three, which one would you choose?
I In regards to what I think the
favorite,
the,
no, yours personally.
Personally, I think the best script he's ever written personally is Steve Jobs. I think the best movie he's ever been involved in is Social Network.
Okay, Jake, what's your favorite Sorkin screenplay? Is it the one you have framed?
Honestly, I think it's Moneyball.
It's interesting.
I love Moneyball. I agree with Kevin in that, like, I think his best work is Social Network, which is why it's framed on my wall and I creeped him out by showing him that. But in terms of the movie of his that I've watched the most, by far, Moneyball.
You're a big baseball guy too, but that
you
script
love
is
baseball guy.
Yeah, that script is genius. I think honestly, my favorite screenplay of his is A Few Good Men.
But that's a testament to him, is that all three of us said something different.
It's such a tremendous script.
I will say, I do think maybe, I don't know if it tops You Can't Handle the Truth, but I think arguably one of the most incredible scenes ever written. Kevin, to your point, that scene in Steve Jobs where the two of them are in a hallway, the whole, like, why do people think I fired you moment, where it cuts back and forth between, that is one. If you don't know what I'm talking about, get on YouTube, Google Steve Jobs, why do people think I fired you? It is one of the best things, not just that he's written, ever written in cinema.
Is that or the Jeff Daniels scene?
Jeff Daniels scene.
That scene.
Yeah, where they're in the hallway and he's saying, like,
it's
why
like
does
raining,
everyone...
Right?
Yeah. Isn't it raining? Yeah, that's it. That's the scene.
Steve Jobs,
for some reason,
absolutely.
I thought they were in an office for some reason.
That is one of the ones I need to revisit, because I'm pretty sure I've only seen that movie one time.
Oh, dude.
And I know I loved it when I saw it.
That might have been in my biopic blend pick.
Oh,
yeah,
possibly.
Steve Jobs is amazing.
Yeah.
Kev, you have an amazing story, if you don't mind telling it, of the amount of travel you squeezed in.
Oh, that's nuts.
To do the Steve Jobs show. So at a time when we are not traveling, can you please share that story?
Yeah, I to this day, I don't know why I did it. I mean,
but you got Sorkin for Steve Jobs, which is awesome.
I'm happy I did it. It was just a little, what Sean's referring to is there was a weekend in around the Steve Jobs junket that was in, it started in New York, and they were doing a press junket for a movie, Pan, which was with Hugh Jackman. Not a great movie.
Movie to be so
was
good.
Was that Joe Wright?
That's Joe Wright.
Joe Wright.
Ooh, yes. Yeah.
And it's funny. I was just wondering, I was going to fill in Joe something, and Jake filled it in right away. I got the Steve Jobs junket, which was going to be a Saturday in London. The Pan junket was Friday in New York, and then Sunday was the walk in New York. So you had this bookended weekend of Friday for Pan and the walk on Sunday, all in New York, and then Steve Jobs randomly in the middle of the weekend in London. So Universal Pictures invites me to Steve Jobs, but they go, we're going to give you everybody except for Steve Jobs himself, Michael Fassbender. Do you want to come to London? And I'm like looking at the talent list. And for me, it was
still a great list.
Right. It was Sorkin and Boyle were the two that I wanted to go for. And then you had a great list of other actors. Seth Rogen was on there. Kate Winslet was on there.
Kate Winslet. That's great.
Yeah. It was it was a big list. So I accepted the junket. So I went to New York on a Thursday, saw Pan on Thursday night, did the Pan interviews Friday, flew to London Friday night, landed in London Saturday morning at 6 a.m., got off the plane, went through customs, went to a 9 a.m. screening of Steve Jobs. And when I was at customs, the guy was like, how long are you here for? I said, 11 hours. I'll see you in 11 hours. When I went through customs in London, and the guy was like waiting for me to say like 2-3 days. And I'm like, no, I'll be back at like 6 p.m. tonight. So I went, I got on the ground in London, got into a car, went right to the screening, saw the movie at 9 a.m., did the junket at noon, was on a flight at 4, back to New York, landed it like at midnight, and then did the walk junket the next day in New York.
That's insanity. Because anyone else who got that invitation would just say, that's okay, I'll just chill in New York for that weekend.
If anything, like, I get a free night in New York.
Yeah.
Yeah. And like, I actually didn't mind doing it that way, because when you're in that much of a time rush, time doesn't really factor into anything, neither does your sleep. So, like, me being on the ground in London for 12 hours, I didn't feel it, to be honest with you. It was so, like, I literally didn't sleep. I mean, I'll never forget, I had a hotel room just so I could change. like, there was a hotel room, because they book it for the junket, and they already had one set aside. So I literally I checked into the room for 4 hours, I think it was, and this I'm in another country. I'm across the pond at this point. But to be honest with you, the 4 minutes to sit down, or 5 minutes it was, to sit down with Danny Boyle, because I think one of the part of the reasons I did it, I'll never forget, one of my really good friends Lauren, not my wife's Lauren's best friend Lauren, sent me this article that Danny Boyle directed the film with 16mm, 35mm, and digital. And I was so astounded and blown away that he chose to do the different decades with different types of film stock and digital cameras that I couldn't miss the opportunity to sit down with him. So to be honest with you, I flew all the way to London to talk to him for 5 minutes about that.
Oh my God. See, I love that for this aspect. There's a scene in, this is going to be such a weird tangent. There's a scene in Lethal Weapon 4, which it's not a good movie. I know you like it more than I do.
I like Lethal Weapon.
But there's a part where they're going to fight Jet Li and they're on the pier at the end of the movie and it's pouring down rain on them. And the two of them decide, like, we're not going to fight him. Like, he's so young. He's really good. We're kind of old. And they're walking away. And then Riggs goes to Murdoch, but he took my gun apart in like one move. You know, how did he do that? How did he take my gun apart? And then Danny Glover turns. He goes, yep, let's go ask him. Like, you get one question in your mind and you're like, I got to fly all the way to London in order to ask this one question. But you're like, yeah, I guess I'm going to fly to London. Let's go ask him.
That was literally the motivation. Like, I'm not kidding you.
Yeah, I know.
And interviewing Aaron Sorkin in person obviously was amazing, but it was like, it was, and also I got to ask Boyle about the train spotting toilet scene, which is another thing I got to like geek out about. So yeah. Like, it was worth it for me. Looking back on it and my body now, I probably would not have done that. But I mean, it was, and I wasn't even getting the title character. That's like going to London for Iron Man and not getting Robert Downey Jr.
It's so weird that he wasn't too impressed for that. That's unusual.
And he was there. Oh no, that was the other part.
I thought he was filming.
No,
stuff.
He was filming. I think what? he was at the press conference that morning.
Right.
He was. I could be wrong and misremembering that, but wasn't he making that movie Assassin's Creed?
Oh, maybe. I thought you told me why he wasn't. Yeah. That's why he didn't do the junket.
He was still physically there. He just didn't have time to do television interviews.
You're saying he didn't want to do the Steve Jobs? Isn't that his jobs?
Right. Yeah, right.
Nothing.
You got jobs. Nothing from
I got,
that.
I got
you
I
got. Oh, that got, was like got, Jake level.
Hey, Gabe.
You got
Gabe,
nothing.
Gabe, cut that in the edit.
Insert laughter.
Insert what exactly?
Insert better joke.
All right. Well, we don't have to travel as much to get amazing interviews these days because we've figured out how to work technology to our benefit and get amazing directors like Julie Taymor, who is joined the show to discuss The Glorias, the film that she has coming out now about Gloria Steinem that stars Alicia Vikander and Julianne Moore. And this was a fantastic conversation. So I'm going to not waste any more time and throw it to the Real Blend interview with Julie Taymor. Yeah, it's a special packaging for a DVD. And a lot of times they come with like specific artwork or I don't know.
I'll take any kind of packaging, anything that's real.
Here's the difference. So this is your standard Blu-ray.
Oh, there you go.
I hate that cover so much.
Why?
We hate it.
Oh,
I hate it. I
love that movie.
Oh, you know, that's so great to hear, because I'm trying to convince people out there to make the same, what do you call it? I don't want to call it Across Universe 2, but the next one. Mm-hmm. I just got off the phone about that, actually.
Across the Galaxy. Really? Call it Across the Galaxy.
That's good. That's
because
good.
There are so many songs you didn't use, or?
My God, there were 200 Beatles songs, so I only used 33. Plus, okay. I'd love to take, Jim Sturgis called me up, and he wants to do it, and Evan's Game, and I'm sure I can get the other people, and I'd like to push it into the 70s. Well, into really edgy, weird times in the 70s that will be very similar to what's going to be happening in our country now, right?
Let's do this. Why aren't we doing this?
Didn't everyone?
I don't know. You got to find me some very daring people who are ready to do a new musical that will be really, you know, next generation. Because, yeah, all people your age, everybody I talk to loves Across the Universe. And
it's amazing.
You got to do the next one. And the Beatles stuff, and Elliot will do new arrangements, and it'll be incredible. And we'll have, I want to go to India. I want to have it be California. You know, there's all kinds of ideas to do it, but I don't have, I haven't really pushed it yet, but I'm ready to.
Doesn't Evan Rachel Wood do Blackbird in the first one?
Yeah.
That's my favorite Beatles song ever. I think that's the moment the film like clicked for me. I was like, because I already loved it. And I'm like, okay, she put Blackbird in there. That's awesome. So that's the best Beatles song.
Yeah, and it was Blackbird referring to her brother who was broken, right? And Elliot did a beautiful job on the arrangement. It was so haunting. So,
Great movie. Sturgis is great in that. Yeah, I actually would love to see it Across the Universe. Chapter 2.
Okay, so cool. You write Sony and tell them you want it.
I'm texting Tom Rothman right now.
Go ahead, because he knows I want to do it. They've got the, I guess they've got the title and they've got the something, but, whatever.
Well, so we're going to dive right into the Glorias then. And thank you so much for taking the time to join us.
Yes. Happy to
do it. So we are a geeky sort of filmmaker driven technical podcast. And so I have to start with a scene that just when I saw it, it dropped my jaw. And I have to ask you, without giving away the magic, I don't want you to reveal any of your tricks. But the tap dance scene in the barbershop.
I didn't know which one you were going to say.
You put mirrors all over that sequence as a challenge to yourself.
Guess what? They were in the barbershop.
Okay,
we didn't put anything there.
Please walk me through as much as you want to pulling that shot off because it's breathtaking.
Yeah. Well, we were in Savannah, Georgia, looking for this barbershop that could be the 1940s, right? Mm. Or 50s. 40s, I think late 40s. And we found it in this neighborhood that, where the houses were, that's supposed to look like East Toledo, where Gloria grew up when she was 11, 12, 13. And it was a African-American barbershop. And everything was there, but then my beautiful production designer and art director, they then put all that detail, because it's phenomenal detail of the period. Rodrigo Prieto, who's the DP and his camera operators and, Steadicam operator, they looked and there were the mirrors. And we loved that as they were dancing, the girls were dancing, you kept getting different aspects of them. But we did know we were going to have to erase it. So it's not a big deal. It was erased in post. And then they had to, which I think was extraordinary, how they put reflections in.
Without
seeing the camera, because if you look at the dailies, the camera's everywhere.
Is that used? Right. Do you put like plates? You shoot a plate of just a shot?
Yes.
You
have to shoot plates. You have to do all of that.
Cool.
We knew it, when we went in there. And I love it. I mean, you it just adds to the musicality and the drama.
Oh, it's fantastic. It brings so much life to that scene, which is just a wonderful moment for the character and fantastic. And I love Savannah. We go to
the barbershop and I think it's, that little girl had never acted before, but what a tap dancer, the African-American girl. She's phenomenal. And it's improvised. I mean, I let them go free. We did some rehearsals, but then I really wanted I didn't want it to look like a dance number in a musical.
Right. No, it doesn't come across.
No,
it doesn't come across that way.
Yeah, good.
Julie, I'm interested in asking you, because you won the Tony for directing The Lion King, and you've worked obviously in stage and film and obviously a bunch of different mediums. And I'm just interested to ask you, if you were to approach the Glorias on stage, how would you even start that process? Like, could you imagine doing scenes from your film, but having it play out theatrically on a stage with an audience?
Not really. To me, the cinema of it is really, it's very important. Going to India, I don't want to have it be stylized India. Because what you have in the Glorias is three levels of reality. You have what is the norm, the dramatic with Alicia Vikander and all these, and Bette Midler and Julianne and all these wonderful actors acting out scenes. Then you have the documentary footage, which is, some of it is archival, a lot of it is, which I don't even want to replace with trying to do it. You can't do the 1963 March on Washington, but I think, what is this? You're a geek, so you'll appreciate this. I had that in black and white with Martin Luther King speaking in Across the Universe. Remember? That march was there when he, and the Vietnam vets are watching it from the hospital. Mm-hmm. It's in black and white. Mostly people have seen that march in black and white because it's stunning. Film. It's film. It's not video. Well, we were going to have to then take our contemporary actors, you know, the scenes with Mrs. Green walking and everything. And I was going to say, oh my God, if I put it into black and white, I'm actually breaking my rules. Oh. Because the bus out of time is black and white. But we thought we were going to have to do it until my incredible archivist, this researcher, found, and my editor, Sabine Hoffman, found color footage from that era that almost nobody uses. Wow. So that's real color footage, archival footage. And then what we did in post was we colorized it to match the color of the period. And we had different layers of grain. We shot in video, but the grain.
Well, like to add it to the
added grain to our footage.
That was a question I was going to ask you actually was about that was how you did that. Yeah.
So is a scene where Julianne is walking and she's being interviewed by the news camera. Is that correct? Where it sort of transitions from archival footage to her on the sidewalk? Because there was a moment when it sort of transitioned from archival footage to her walking along on the sidewalk. And I thought the transition was so smooth that it almost looked like you were...
Which one is that? Sure, it's Julianne, because in Washington, it's Alicia Vikander.
Okay.
And
this was...
I know what you're talking about.
Later in the film. Yes.
Okay. So the Houston Women's Conference, we combined really crappy video footage from the 70s.
Okay.
And there was no good because they switched to video back then for the news.
Okay.
So I had to make a choice. Walking on the sidewalk, obviously we shot. Mm-hmm. And Bette Midler, Bell Abzug walking up into this incredible, location we found in Savannah, Georgia, to be the convention center. And then inside the convention center, we had about 200 women. This was one of our biggest days. But that big shot with the girls and their torches running down,
yeah,
that's a lot of CGI people. That is a lot. And then, again, with color and grain, we did as close as we could to matching some of the real stuff. But at a certain point, I just threw up my hands and I said, you know what? It doesn't matter. Right. The audience now is used to documentary footage, archival footage, mixing in with the real. And it added a layer of edginess, in fact. You know, the planks when all the different women are getting up and talking about. I had shot some of that. And I opted for the real thing because at that point I thought better to do each one that was real and then come back to Bella and Gloria Steinem at the end where they hold up their arms for the ERA. Mm. So that's the second level of reality, which is real reality, right? You know, the real documentary footage. The third is the surreality. And in that category, that's what people would say is more theatrical. Like someone would say, having four Glorias interacting with each other seems like theater. No one does it in film, not the way I did it. It's not like the Bob Dylan thing. Those were all separate.
Right,
right, right.
Not at all like that one, whatever that was.
That was the movie with Heath Ledger. And Yeah,
that was just different.
I'm not here.
Yeah, that's not what we were doing. what I was trying to do was to have, you know, inner monologues that were, you know, inner ideas that were in her book. I said, well, I'm going to make them cinematic by putting them in the mouths of the actors. And then you get how a younger Gloria isn't able to talk, like with that scene, she's in the taxi with Saul Bellow and Gay Talese. And he says that obnoxious statement about, you know, every year a pretty girl comes until she gets married. And Gloria in her 30s had no answer to say. It was so utterly shocking that someone would lean over her and say that when she's a journalist going out to interview Bobby Kennedy. And then we pop in Julianne Moore, who by that time in her 40s and later had found her voice and humor with her voice. Mm-hmm. Some of us are actually becoming the men we thought we wanted to marry. Because I can cut to the outside of a cab and show her leaning in, it's seamless. Doing it in theater, you could do that part in theater. I just have no interest. I found, you know, I mean, that footage, that cab, can you believe what's behind that? I mean, you guys should appreciate this. Other people won't even notice. That is New York City in the 70s.
Right.
Did you front project it or did you add it in post?
No, it's green screen. We shot all the taxis and the bus in a studio in Savannah.
Wow.
Okay. With a green screen. Then we created those beautiful, much more impressionistic outdoors of the bus, right? Those are very, I didn't want them to be specific places. Mm-hmm. So you could get winter, you could get cold, you could get fields, but honestly, it's black and white, so we kept it very misty, not clear. But the real stuff, the taxi in Boston with Flo Kennedy and Gloria Steinem, Alicia Vikander and Lorraine Toussaint, that is Boston in the 70s. Wow. And man, the amount of research that went into this to find it and then to be able to take out a car, put in a car. There's a lot of post on this movie, a lot.
Okay.
I want to build
other surreal things. Excuse me, I've got one more to do.
Go ahead, please.
But the other surreal are these flights of fancy, like the tornado or the tap dancing, Fred Astaire tap dancing in this Hollywood fantasy that the 12-year-old Gloria has, or the conveyor belts, which was inspired by, I mostly got everything from one book, My Life on the Road, but then later I remember reading in her 50s, she felt like her life was like she was running on a treadmill. Mm. I thought, a treadmill, that's pretty cool. Yeah. Why don't I needed some, often it's for a segue, right? It's often for a segue. I need to figure out how to go from that taxi ride where she finally explodes at the racist taxi cab driver to her peaceful older self reading from her book in India. That would have been a weird leap. So I had the energy, and Elliot's music is so fucking awesome there, of her on these treadmills that became the highway. So we already know the motif of the highway from the bus, the yellow slash line. Mm-hmm. And the red shoes harkens to the ruby slippers. So we have the Wizard of Oz being, you know, tapped into throughout. She talks about it in her book, The Wizard of Oz. Mm-hmm. You know, there's no place like home. There's no place like home. Remember in that scene. And also the red shoes of Michael Powell's film, which is bad girl. When you get too much hubris or you have too much ambition to be a ballet star, you're going to dance and you won't be able to stop. So I was kind of trying to take tropes and ideas of, you know, in the tornado, the witch bitch thing, you know, the witches of double toil and trouble Macbeth or the, you know, the witch from The Wizard of Oz or the witch of Harry Potter, the little girl flying around on her broomstick.
Right.
So those are closer to Across the Universe, the kind of medium animation, the Kali animation for the cover of the guy who did that animation, the beautiful Kali on the cover of Miz.
For the Miz cover?
He did the I Want You. He did the animation of Uncle Sam. And I said, who did that? I gotta find that guy. He's out in Oregon. So I said, here's the cover, make it dance. And I gave him images of Bharatanatyam and various other Indian dancing. And we went back and forth and it was pure pleasure. I mean, I loved working on the post with the visual effects teams was hard, but it was really satisfying ultimately.
That's awesome. I would like to dig in a little bit deeper in terms of the actors and the performances, because you singled out that you do something that most people don't do when they're doing a biopic and different actors are playing the same character at different stages. You would never dream of having them interact in the same scene. It's rare to see it happen. Right. So a lot of times when you talk to directors who do that, they encourage their performers to not really look at the footage of what the other person is doing and to just focus on their era. But when you have Alicia sort of interacting with Julianne, do you want them to not like mimic each other? Do you want them to still define what their version of Gloria is? How did you approach that?
They were not to mimic each other, and they wouldn't have wanted to. I mean, they're mostly not together, and the bus shots, those ones where they're on the bus, the Greyhound bus, was the last few days of shooting in Savannah.
Okay.
So they'd already etched their characters fully in their own time periods. We hadn't done India yet, because India we went after Savannah, of course. But they both had dialect coaches, separate. So they both had the documentary footage of the real Gloria, and they had the real Gloria. She came down to my apartment and we all had meetings and they got to ask her questions and listen to her and they could call her anytime. And she came, you know, we're not going to do the spoiler alert about Gloria, but she did come to the set the last day that we were in Savannah. So you know, she was a part of this process. Gloria Steinem was. She answered anything I want. She loved what was going on. She was sort of startled that it could even happen. So, and she completely trusted the ideas.
You know, Julie, going off Sean's question, I'm actually interested in asking this. When you're casting people who are playing the same person at different ages, what goes into the thought process? Because the audience has to believe it, right? We have to believe that these actors are playing the same person at different stages in their life. Now, they don't have to look exactly like each other. There has to be certain elements that are just going to be a through line, and people change as they get older. As you cast different people, what are you looking for that's consistent through all the performances that helps us immerse in the world and believe it?
Well, I think that they're very different, actually.
Yeah,
and it still works.
Right.
And I think it's because she really did change as she got older. Now they have the humor. They have maybe the 12-year-old is less humor, but the enjoyment of wanting to be a dancer and the knife throwing thing and the little one is very cocky from time to time and she adores her father, and they all had the love of Leo, and the empathy for Ruth grew. Like the 12-year-old's relationship is with her mother. The 6-year-old relationship is with her father, you know, and then the 20-year-old's relationship, Alicia Vikander, is back again with her father. And the Gloria that Julianne plays is disconnected. But that scene when they're all on the bus after he passes is, you know, they're together and not together. They each have their own look out the window at his car and remember about travel, traveling with him. So obviously for the two older Glorias, the hair connected them. You know, sometimes it's browner, but finally when the streaks happen, the Gloria Steinem streaks and the aviator glasses, that's the Gloria, the visual Gloria that most people know.
Right.
That came in her late 30s. You know, I put the hair at the bunnies when she goes undercover as a bunny, which wasn't necessarily the time, but I just needed it to make sense that she comes up with new hair. She gives a fake name, Marie. So, you know, it makes sense that she would do something glossy at that time. And the glasses, you know, they are really, the women ended up looking like Gloria, which is astounding to me.
I have to say that there was one scene.
Julianne does look like Gloria when you look at these pictures there. And the younger Gloria can look like Alicia. So, and she had dark hair. So we played with Alicia's real hair until she became, you know, goes into that further journalist when she becomes a real journalist.
I forget what scene it was, but I swear there was a moment, and because you had played around with switching him in and out of scenes, especially with the taxicab one, where I had to almost look really closely and be like, is that Alicia or is it Julianne? Like, I wasn't sure which one.
I think that's the scene where I switched them. About halfway through the movie, we have Alicia being interviewed by that journalist in the TV.
It was. That was the scene.
Okay, so that they're on the set together. That's the other one besides where they were together on the set in a studio, that TV studio, and they had to have the exact same hair color, the exact same clothing, boots, and position. So it was up to Julianne to mimic. That's one place where we replace her and she steps right in.
Okay.
They're both supposed to be about 40 years old. So you have to believe it both ways. I mean, one's younger, one's older, but they did it as actresses.
I think that's fantastic, though. It continues the themes
really
of the movie that you're trying to push forward through. Speaking of continuing the themes, too, there, I love the scenes where Gloria would approach a boss with what seemed to be a home run idea at the time, only to be met with, you can't do that, you know, like, can you take the safer path? And I'm really curious, because you really take big swings when you do come around to make films, how prevalent that attitude is in the film.
Oh my God, I think a lot more films if that attitude weren't there.
Really?
I mean, yeah, I have 7 projects I've been wanting to make for the last 10, 15 years. Some of them are newer. I'm right when I missed calling you, I was in the middle of writing a screenplay, a new one, and I'm writing it all myself. And, you know, I was offered money to do it, but I decided I know what's going to happen. If I take the money, it'll change the screenplay later. So I don't want the money. Let me finish the screenplay. If you like it, that's the movie that I want to make. Mm-hmm. You know, and my things are outside of the box. This movie was we couldn't get the money in Hollywood, even with a best-selling book, Gloria Steinem, never been a movie about this part of history, me and Julianne Moore attached, you know, and then we had a script. And people wanted to do it, but for $10 million or less.
Okay.
Now, you don't make a movie that's 80 years, two continents, traveling. Come on, let's be realistic. It's not just a little chick flick in a kitchen and a living room and bedroom. It has, I don't know how many scenes, but a lot.
It's epic in scope. Yeah.
It's epic, like movies about Martin Luther King or Winston Churchill or LBJ or, come on, guys, men and women. This is a hero, a living hero. I mean, she was on, look how she's on TV. No, she didn't talk about the movie last night. She was with Joy Reid on MSNBC talking about Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Because who's better to talk about it than Gloria?
Yeah, right.
And when we talk about protest and what's going to happen with Roe v. Wade and gender rights and ERA that hasn't been passed yet and all the things that are coming up on the chopping block if things go the way Trump wants them to go and the Republicans don't raise their arms up and say, wait a second, we have a democracy here. You know, come on. Gloria is the living representation of that continuation of those protests. And are we moving backwards? Maybe. And do young men and women have to really think? And I mean, this movie sadly is incredibly, it's a clarion call. Is that the word? To say, you know, Gloria says at the, in the, Women's March, pressing send is not enough.
Right, right.
So, I just think, well, I don't even know what I think. I think I've been off on a tangent
Kevin, I'm going to jump just for one second because do want to follow up on that. I want to know, this is such an inspirational film and really is a call to action. Did you fight harder to make sure that it got in front of audiences before the election took place?
Yes, we did, because we have a wonderful distributor, Roadside Attractions, but they're film distributors. Mm-hmm. And up until August, they were hoping to release it. And my producer, Lynn Hindy, and Gloria Steinem and myself said, and then so they were actually probably not fully, because they get the political clout it might have, but they were thinking of postponing.
Okay.
And I thought, and Gloria said, no, we were planning to be on a Greyhound bus in September and October, moving through the swing states, presenting this film to groups, women's groups, men's groups, it doesn't matter. Hopefully people who don't even know, we're going to be in swing states, so they hadn't necessarily, to open up this kind of what Gloria has as a talking circle, you know, like a large talking circle. Okay, so we can't do that. So we're doing as much press Zooms as possible. And they did, Roadside Attractions said, okay, we'll give in, we'll go to streaming if we can. And Amazon signed on, so we're opening on the 30th. But I said, we've got to do this and get people to register to vote, because right now I think it's gotten worse, much worse. We need actually a landslide. It can't even be close.
Yeah.
Right. Otherwise, Biden will lose. It just will. It'll go, you know, I mean, I don't want to say that.
Scare now.
Happen. But it, you know, every young person, and you're not voting for Biden, you're voting against a bad future.
Yes.
That's what I want people to, don't worry about Biden. He's going to have a team of people who care about the environment, care about lesbian and gay and transgender issues, care about health for all, care about COVID. I should have said that first, because really it is the main thing. And then that's how our economy will come back.
Right.
So I think people really have to say, no voting is a vote for Trump, period.
Right.
No voting, you're voting for Trump.
Right.
And don't even think about it, because it's the only right we all have equally, and he's trying to take that away and make it invalid. So I do feel like this movie has definitely, this working on this for the last 4 or 5 years has made me much more conscious of how much these activists, and there's the other thing about the movie, I wanted to do it as much for Gloria as for the women of color who actually were at the forefront of the women's movement. Mm. Flo Kennedy, Dorothy Pittman Hughes, you know, we have Wilma Mankiller, Dolores Huerta, Bella Abzug, because back then being a Jewish woman from New York is a woman of color, frankly, let's not forget the times. Yeah. And it was the anti-Semitism was greatly used against her. So, which may come back again here, as we can see with the sort of white supremacist attitude. So I think that Gloria, who's a great listener, I love when the Indian woman in the bookstore calls her the India from Indian woman, India from India, Indian from India. You'll have to cut through this. When she says she's been called, Gloria has been called a celestial bartender.
As every good journalist should be. Every good journalist needs to be a good listener.
A good listener. And that's how things change. You know, it's just, it's so critical. Anyway, yeah.
You know, Julie, I want to talk to you about your collaborators, because Rodrigo Prieto is one of the greatest cinematographers of all time. You go, look at the movies he's made. I mean, the stuff with Scorsese, did Argo with Affleck. I mean, he's brilliant. I want to talk to you about that relationship, and specifically the choice of shooting on video, digital, considering this was, you know, there's a film aspect to the way it looks. And I'm wondering the choice there not to shoot on film versus digital. And also your collaboration with Elliot. I mean, like, this is, you know, the music you've worked on with him over the years. I know he won the Oscar for Frida. I know you're his partner in real life. I'm just wondering, like, specifically kind of like those working relationships. And I guess we'll start first with Rodrigo and kind of this choice of digital versus film. And then we'll end with Elliot.
Okay. Yeah, well, I met Rodrigo on Frida. He had just done Amores Perros, right?
Oh,
I
think that was the film. One of the greatest movies ever made. Oh,
right.
Yeah.
So I gave him his first, I think, American film. Mm. I think it might've been the first. Okay. And because I was shooting in Mexico, it's very important to me to work with as many Mexican, my team, you know, the key players.
Yeah.
So Felipe Fernandez was the production designer. Actually, my costume designer was American. I just didn't quite find the person I want. But art director, everybody, the crew was Mexican, mostly.
Your costumes are gorgeous.
They are. But that was Judy Weiss. So she did a great job, but she is not Mexican. Mm. And we shot everything in Mexico, and I knew that he was really good with handheld, but frankly, we decided, because it's about portraits, to use 1.85 and to use lighting. And, it was my second feature film. I'd done Titus before, which he loved, and which is my favorite film, actually.
Really? I like to hear that. That's cool. That's cool.
Yeah. No, I love Titus.
Yeah.
Not everything in it, but I love it.
Yeah.
But Rodrigo was, he was the camera operator, which he still is from time to time, even on this one. But I learned so much with him. For instance, knowing how good he was at handheld, you know, in Amores Perros, I was very careful about that, because I'm so sick of people using Steadicam and handheld for everything without any fucking thought. You know, we set up the camera, you create scenes, paintings, moving pictures, as they were called. And you use the handheld when you want agitation.
Yep, right.
So in the scene where she and Diego get married and then there's this big scuffle going on, yeah, that was handheld. When there's riots, that's handheld. But I think people get very lazy and they just put up two or three cameras.
Yep.
And even when I was on, this is the first film that I've shot digitally.
Yeah.
Well, A Midsummer Night's Dream, which is a little different, which Rodrigo shot for me as well. But that was a live theater production. We had four cameras shooting two performances live. And then we went on stage with audience that we brought in and used handheld and Steadicam and dollies and all kinds of stuff.
Cool.
So it's a combination to make that, which is much better than most of those theater live from National Theater. The Met, the first Met HD is my production of The Magic Flute. So, I've done that too. But so Rodrigo was amazing. And then, you know, I had Kim Jennings, who was the production designer. She'd worked for years with Mark Friedberg, who had done Across the Universe and The Tempest. And she worked on both of those in the art department, either art directing or in the art department. And I did ask Mark to do this because I love working with him. And I'm glad he said no, that he was unavailable, because I really did also need to really try and get women in these positions. And he said, Kim, she's never had the full out. I said, yes, that's great. And it couldn't have been better, actually, because it's her first, she worked her ass off. She made a lookbook this thick, you know, like a foot high. Yeah. And she just did a phenomenal job. You know the scene on the pier, Ocean Beach Pier? That's completely constructed. That's a set.
Wow.
Gloria said that looks exactly like the real one.
Oh my
gosh.
So
we actually built that, and those, the house and the pier are in totally different locations. So that's done, you know, through the magic of post, connecting them.
That's incredible.
You know, and you have to do, you know, where's the camera? Yeah. How do you pull the cars to go from there to the next scene? And then I'd worked with Sandy Powell before, who has also done all of Scorsese's, and Sandy did The Tempest for me. So Sandy, I said, Sandy, this is going to be much more low budget than Scorsese. You're spoiled. You're not going to be able to do this. It's 1500, you know, costumes in 80 years. And she said, but it's women. And for Scorsese, it's lots of suits. Okay. You know, I just get like two or three women. So I want to do this. And of course, she did a phenomenal job. And my editor is somebody new for me, Sabine Hoffman. So she lives in New York. I never worked with her. And I started out looking for a female editor because I had always had female editors. I mean, my editor, my great long-term editor and friend was Françoise Bonneau, who passed away, sadly. And so, you know, and she had done The Tempest, Titus, Frida, Across the Universe. Mm-hmm. So it was very scary to have somebody new, but Sabine was phenomenal.
Sure, that relationship is so close.
Yeah, it's very, very close. So I was really happy. So we do have a lot of women in key positions, which is amazing. And our producers are all women.
Yeah. That's fantastic. That's fantastic.
Oh, and then also just on Elliot real fast before.
That's most important. He's right there in the kitchen. if you wanted to come out, he just finished, he was finishing last night at 8 a.m. or this morning, the score to be able to be gettable online.
Oh, fantastic.
And it's beautiful. It won't be the songs because those are too expensive. Yeah, it's his score and it's stunning. So yeah, Elliot is my, you know, he's the go-to guy for me because I think he can do anything. Mm. You know, whether he does Batman or Alien 3 or Butcher Boy or Drugstore Cowboy or Frida or Titus and all my films, I wouldn't go to anybody else. Mm. And Across the Universe, he did 80%, I would say, of the arrangements and the score. He's the dominant person who did those, like your favorite Blackbird, or you know how he really reduced I Want to Hold Your Hand, how he slowed it down and really
I love that moment.
So the ones that don't at all sound like the Beatles are his, you know, I mean,
they're
all the new arrangements. Yeah.
That's amazing.
That's awesome.
We are out of time, unfortunately. We burned through all of our time, but we thank you so much for joining us. And obviously, we're sending everybody to go see The Glorias.
Great. Be so inspired glad. By thank it. You, guys. So wonderful.
We really appreciate your time, Seymour. We'll talk to you soon. It was so much fun to talk to Julie Taymor. She is a genius and has amazing credits to her name. We're going to talk about The Glorias a little bit later in the show, so stay tuned for our reactions to that movie. Let's get to this week's talking points. We have a running joke now on the show that every single time we record, the next day, major news tends to break. And in this case, it was, we spent 11 minutes on last week's episode talking about whether Black Widow should go to Disney Plus and how much people would pay for it. And this is what they should do. I even had the greatest slogan of
Black Widow Friday.
Yeah, exactly.
Come on.
And instead they punted it to next
May.
What
a waste.
So no MCU films in 2020. They are pushing the entire slate back, which means that the next Marvel movie that we will get is Black Widow in May of 2021. Again, providing that everything stays on track. That pushed Shang-Chi back from May to July. And that pushed The Eternals, which was a November movie, to February to following November. So everything's getting shifted back. I know that I'm King Marvel here. Do you guys have an opinion about this, or doesn't feel like that bad waiting for it?
You know, I'm fine.
You're fine.
It almost falls into that Star Wars camp where it's like, you know, make me miss you a little bit.
Yeah.
And honestly, if there were a moment to take a break and let us breathe and let us catch our breath, like, isn't now the time? They didn't start like Endgame and Spider-Man kind of wrapped up this huge epic story. They haven't got it started on the next phase yet. Like, there could not be a better time to break, push everything back, and just let us like chill for a second. Like, I'm perfectly fine. Now, if this had happened Like, how crazy would the world be going if it were in-game that they were pushing back?
Oh, I know. I know. They extremely lucked out in terms of where the break fell.
So like, how do you feel? Like, I always say that, like make me miss Star Wars. Like give me a few years of no Star Wars. How do you feel about having to wait a year before Marvel?
I really miss it. And I really, with all due respect to everyone who's involved in Black Widow, I don't want that to be the movie that kicks off the next phase. I wish they were starting with fresh and new. I wish it was Shang-Chi. I wish it was Eternals. I wish it was something else, which is part of the reason why I still stand by the fact that Black Widow should have just been put on Disney Plus. Let people see it and let them start with fresh and new movies.
Sean, how do they decide what's going to start their phases? So Far From Home the start of the phase?
That was definitely the end of phase three.
Yes. So why was Endgame not the end of Phase 3?
Well, far they haven't ended with an event. You would think they'd want to end with an Avengers film, which they did end Phase 1 with an Avengers film. But then Phase 2 ended with an Ant-Man film, actually. Mm-hmm. And so they kind of looked at it as like a palate cleanse after a heavy movie. You know, let's drop a big Avengers movie, and then we'll give you something light to sort of wipe the slate clean. But now that... That was back when they didn't even really think of them as like they were thought of as phases, but there wasn't like a narrative thread behind all the phases. The Infinity Saga is without a doubt the closure of the Infinity Saga. And they kind of wanted Far From Home to become the next, like, this is still buttoning up everybody dealing with what happened after the snap kind of thing.
Yeah. A nice little epilogue kind of.
It was an epilogue of sorts for sure. And then you would assume Black Widow would have kicked everything off. Again, strange. Well, I honestly think it was supposed to be Guardians of the Galaxy 3. That was supposed to be the next launch, which is why Thor left with the Guardians at the end of Endgame. That movie was supposed to be down for May of 2021, I want to believe. And then James Gunn got fired. And then that was the first thing that sent everything into a wrench. That moved Black Widow up when that movie got shifted. And so they would have been on a different path as it is anyway. So what we will get is WandaVision by the end of this year. So you get a TV show. But then I wish they had a February movie. I really do. And who knows what February is going to look like? I mean, you know, everyone keeps saying, 2021, but it's not going to be immediate. So all that stuff got pushed back. That's where we're at the Marvel movies.
Why do you think West Side Story moved a year?
God, I don't know. Do you think because he just wants that Christmas slot? He wants the December slot?
Yeah, I don't think it's a matter of it not being done, because I think if Spielberg wants people to work on stuff from home, or he wants to work on stuff from home, I think he can. I think they realize it's not coming out this year, and he wants to be in the Oscar race next year. So, like, in theory, like, it could be ready for summer, I'm sure, of next year, but I think they just went, we'll just push it back a year.
But with the new Oscar regulations, you guys saw that Cherry was bought for $40 million by Apple, and that movie can compete in next year's Academy Awards because it's going to be coming out with what's the time frame again? April?
I thought it was end of February. The show's in April. The show is in April. Eligibility is through end of February.
So that means Cherry would possibly come out January or February.
Gabe?
Theoretically.
Yeah, I was going to note something else to previously talking about the release date. I think you're right that it's an awards movie and they want to be in that traditional awards slot. But also In the Heights, if this is correct, what I'm finding here, and I never know these days with release dates.
It's a summer release.
It's set for June of 2021. Yeah. So I imagine they want to get some distance from
I have a question. And I'm not obviously, like, by no means am I ever the person that would doubt Spielberg, but like, I want to talk about, like, Oscar hopes for West Side Story. Like, has a movie that won Best Picture ever been remade to go on and win Best Picture again?
No, not yet. Not that I'm aware of.
I don't know if it's Best Picture, but I think it's the sort of thing where Academy voters are going to be excited about Spielberg remaking a classic movie, and they're, you know, what if they get 5 technical awards? I think it's probably still...
It's like A Star Is Born. A Star Is Born was a phenomenal film, but it didn't win because it was like the fourth remake. And again, I don't know that for sure, but I do think that Star Is Born was not hated on, but I think it was looked at differently. That's kind of why I felt bad about what happened to that film, because I think what Bradley Cooper made was so special. And it just happened to be that it was the fourth whatever remake of a classic story. So I think that actually counted against it. The interesting thing here, like, I think what Gabe is saying with Spielberg involved, that does raise it, obviously, the bar. But The Post, for example, like I thought that was going to be a gigantic Oscar film. And I don't remember its nominations. I'm sure it got Best Picture nomination. I don't know if did Spielberg get
director. I don't think Spielberg got nominated.
I don't think so. No. And so I'm starting to wonder how much weight goes into a name being behind a film now in regards to the Oscars. And, you know, I think the Oscars want to, I don't know. I mean, West Side Story has a lot going for it in regards to Spielberg's name being on it, but I do fear that it will, again, we haven't seen it, that it might fall into that Star is Born category where it's, oh, we've seen this already. Mm-hmm. Does it really need to win? But I don't know. Yeah. It might be.
Do you guys,
but Star is Born was amazing.
When you mentioned The Post, do you remember that? And I kind of feel bad because I actually love The Post. And Sean, I think it was your number one.
My number one that year. Yeah. Yes.
Do you remember that Golden Globes joke when he was like talking about The Post? He's like, oh, it's a Steven Spielberg movie. It's about the importance of journalism in this time. And it stars Tom Hanks and Meryl Streep. And someone carts out like a giant cart full of Golden Globes. And he goes like, no, not yet, not yet. The joke being that it was going to win everything. Right, and it ended up winning nothing.
I know.
Well, that, and didn't Star is Born win one Oscar?
For song, right?
Definitely. Yeah. Definitely one song.
Like, it won like no Oscars. Like in the sense of like, but again, to Jake's point, it's like the movies that you always assume
Oscar bait.
I do genuinely, and again, I know that Bradley Cooper is probably not hurting about this at this point because he's making PTA's new movie, and I'm sure he's fine. But I think that film was unfairly judged.
Probably, sure.
If that makes sense.
But I can honestly see West Side Story getting like 10 nominations easily with like a bunch of technicals and, you know, cinematography and things like that. But maybe not, maybe go like 10 noms, no wins or something like that.
I can already see the New York Times article like 10 Oscar nominated, 10 including Best Picture and Best Actor, and like, and then
it's absolutely going to land on every top
10 list, NPR.
All those lists are going to put it on. It's a National Board of Review and all that stuff. The Post got 2 Oscar nominations. Do you guys remember what they were?
Meryl Streep.
Did it get Meryl
Streep in picture?
Meryl Streep in picture. Yes.
I am curious before we do eventually move on. Bring this around in the Heights.
We're not done talking Heights, about the I'm Post curious. Yet.
No, we're talking about with talking about that. I'm curious if In the Heights has the ability to, because it's a fresh musical. It's based on a
Lin-Manuel Miranda has that.
It's based on Lin-Manuel Miranda. He's producing it. Like, I think In the Heights is also an Oscar movie. Does that have the chance to come in and go toe-to-toe with it with all those same nominations, but win because it has the benefit of being this fresh new thing?
I feel like if In the Heights were a legit Oscar contender, it would not be coming out in the summer. It seems like a summery, fun musical, but doesn't seem like it has like the weight or the prestige to go the distance.
I don't know the In the Heights story, but I do think it's a weighty story. I think there's like some serious themes, and I don't think it's a jokey type of musical. I've never seen In the Heights, but knowing Lin-Manuel Miranda's work, I have a feeling it's gonna. But to Jake's point, though, I think In the Heights seemed, just based on the trailer, it has a summer feel to it.
Yeah, it seems summery. And also, like, we know that that Oscar voters can't remember past the last time they saw like X, like insert X, and they're not gonna remember both West Side Story and In the Heights. They're not gonna vote for 2 musicals. So which one are they gonna vote for? They're gonna vote for the Spielberg one that just came out that they can brag about having seen before everyone else.
Yeah, it's the last thing on their mind.
Tell me I'm wrong. You know what I'm talking about.
You're right.
No, you're 100% right. It's always like that. Like, but then you have like the outliers which end up like gaining momentum in February or March, like a Get Out or
sure.
By the way, I know we always joke about missing news and then our show ending. So I'm just gonna go ahead and read this because I just saw it. So did you guys see the Borat sequel news?
No.
So
I know they want it out before the election, don't they?
Yeah.
Well, because title is about Mike Pence.
Yeah. So Amazon, this is according to, I'll give Deadline credit. It says Borat sequel acquired by Amazon Studios. Sacha Baron Cohen film will bow on Prime Video right before the election day.
Oh, that's amazing. That's actually pretty sweet. Yeah. I would like to, what do you mean it's about Mike Pence? I didn't hear this at all.
The title. Hold on. Let me read the title. Borat.
It just says Borat 2.
No, it has an official title. You remember how the first one had that long title? It.
Wait, the first one was called Borat Cultural Learnings of America for Making Benefit of Glorious Nations of Kazakhstan.
But this one is called, are you ready for it?
Sure.
Please.
Borat, gift of pornographic monkey to Vice Premier Michael Pence to make benefit recently diminished nation of Kazakhstan.
Is that real?
Yeah, well, I'll read that again.
Why Borat, would Deadline not have that in their article? Yeah.
Borat, gift of pornographic monkey to Vice Premier Michael Pence to make benefit recently diminished nation of Kazakhstan.
Oh my God, I want to see this so bad.
Dude, no, you don't get to say that because when I texted you guys, we're getting a Borat sequel. Didn't you reply back like, meh, like,
no,
who cares?
I think I did.
Yes, you did.
No,
and I replied
back to
like,
you.
Who hurt you?
Oh, and then I sent a picture of the two naked guys wrestling.
Yes. Yeah, so you don't get to laugh at this movie.
Well, I've changed my mind.
I hope you sit in silence. No, you don't get to change your mind on this show. This show is concrete.
Everything is set in stone.
I mean, that's smart.
Oh, yeah.
Amazon Prime. I mean, I'm reading the articles now. Jake, I'm not seeing that title anywhere in any of these articles.
It's,
are you
that's
sure
the title.
It's real?
Yeah.
If it's not, it should be. How about that?
I'm seeing it everywhere.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
Turn holiday travel from stressful to rewarding. Rakuten helps you save big on travel. They give you cash back when you book with sites like Expedia, Best Western, and Hertz. Even better, you can stack cash back on top of other rewards, like airline miles, credit card points, and hotel loyalty programs. Rakuten partners with over 3,700 stores, including Away Luggage, Ray-Ban, and Macy's, so you can be prepared with all the travel essentials, and of course, cute fits for your trip. Keep the rewards going with cash back on holiday gifts for friends and family. With Rakuten, you'll never miss out on savings at your favorite stores. The stores pay Rakuten for sending them shoppers, and Rakuten shares the money with you as cash back. Join for free and start your shopping at Rakuten.com or use the Rakuten app. That's Rakuten.
All right, well, while those guys look into that, let's shift into something that's deeply disturbing to me. Barry Jenkins is going to be directing a Lion King follow-up. Okay, so we ran that it was a sequel. I got called by the studio for a correction that it's not a sequel. It is a follow-up. So I don't quite...
Which, by the way, is not your fault. And I want to give Sean credit because we get news so quickly. Barry Jenkins' tweet says sequel.
It does, yes.
The
does
director really? Of the film says sequel yes. on his Twitter.
I saw the Hollywood Reporter report prequel.
Prequel?
If you go to
their article said prequel. I was so confused.
So here's Barry Jenkins' tweet. He says this, yes, this. And then I don't know if he just copied the title from Deadline, but his tweet says the Lion King sequel set with Moonlight director Barry Jenkins to helm for Walt Disney Studios.
All right. Well, neither here nor there, whether it's a sequel or a follow-up. I'm less concerned about that than I am, A, the fact that they are staying in this world, and B, that Barry Jenkins is doing it. And listen... Barry Jenkins can choose to do whatever he wants to do. I know we make this argument a lot of times that you don't want to see a filmmaker get swept up into a franchise machine or do a big budget movie. Barry Jenkins in particular seems to be one of these people with a very clear, defined voice who has the ability to tell really strong stories in the African-American community or in any community that he chooses to. And I would love to see three original Barry Jenkins movies with the budget he's going to get for The Lion King. So that's disheartening to me.
But here's the interesting thing about it. So when you're a filmmaker who primarily works in smaller, independent type of films, if Beale Street Could Talk, Moonlight, sometimes you need the larger picture clearly to then make your... So look at Guy Ritchie, for example. Guy Ritchie is a great example. You do Aladdin, then you get to do your Gentleman movie. You know what I mean? Like, and I think... I don't think that that's what Barry Jenkins's thought process is. I just based on what I can understand. I mean, Beale Street did not do well in theaters.
Right.
Moonlight won Best Picture, but I don't think it made more than $30 million worldwide.
Right.
And again, that doesn't speak to the quality of the film. I mean, Aladdin made $1 billion. Doesn't mean it's a great movie. You know what I mean?
Sure.
I do think though that maybe, and again, this is just completely guessing, that Jenkins needs some type of bigger production around him to do, and then if he wants to continue working in the indie scene. Now, that being said, Lion King has a lot of themes in it that I think Barry Jenkins will be able to explore. And I think that Barry Jenkins is one of the best filmmakers working today. I think Beale Street was an absolute genius film. I mean, that the music in that film was absolutely incredible. But I wonder if here's what I'm trying to get at. Guy Ritchie's voice was nowhere to be found in Aladdin.
Correct.
It wasn't there.
Correct.
That was not a Guy Ritchie movie. It was it was a Disney film that just had Guy Ritchie's name on it.
Correct.
I worry in this particular instance whether or not Barry Jenkins' voice will come through a major production. Like, what's Favreau's voice, right? Favreau directed the Lion King remake. What's his voice? I think he's a great director who doesn't necessarily have a specific signature style to him.
Would it almost be like pizza with no toppings on it?
Yeah.
Are you saying he doesn't have a flavor?
But cheese pizza is still amazing.
Do you know who I would compare Jon Favreau to? The most is Ron Howard. I think Ron Howard is a perfectly
Ron Howard doesn't have a necessarily. Filmmaker. Yeah, I don't think Ron Howard has like
Ron a... Ron Howard like, is a hell of a lot better of a filmmaker than Jon Favreau.
No, but what Sean is saying, I think Ron Howard...
Jon Favreau could not make Apollo 13.
Ron Howard has a better filmography and is a better director than Jon Favreau. But I think what Sean's saying is that they both have... There's really... I guess what's Ron Howard's distinct voice? I don't know. I think
holding on to Tom Hanks as hard as he can.
I mean, he's a good storyteller, but
sure,
I mean,
wouldn't.
His voice?
Ron Howard's whole process is because he comes from an acting background. His whole process is finding a script.
Right.
The same as when we talked about like Spielberg. His whole process is finding a script and then trying to get really talented people around him to help tell this specific story.
Absolutely.
It's not really like, ooh, it needs to have this grit because I'm attracted to this. Like he's very fluid in the way that he tells the stories, and it comes across as he doesn't have a distinct style.
They're just good general storytellers.
Sure.
I think at the end of the day, Spielberg's, the Ron Howard's, like they're just phenomenal, straightforward storytellers. And that's not a bad thing. They're just great at telling any story in any genre. But then,
and they're not the star of the show. Like when Ron Howard directs a movie, he's not, about his, like his style, like, Chris Nolan is the star of a Chris Nolan movie.
Exactly.
Howard is not the star of a Ron Howard movie.
Exactly. Like Nolan and Tarantino and Scorsese and all these guys, like those filmmakers have a very distinct, like that's what, part of the reason why I was so taken back by Once Upon a Time in Hollywood at first, because it wasn't normally what I perceive Quentin Tarantino's voice to sound like. Right.
Sure.
And so that was a bit jarring. So going back to the full circle, back to Barry Jenkins here. I worry that his voice will not be there.
Okay.
But considering who Barry Jenkins is, that he has a Best Picture under his belt, and that I guarantee you he probably went to the table with, if we're going to do this, I need you to let me do X, Y, and Z. And I don't know what Guy Ritchie's deal was with Aladdin, but that movie could have been directed by McGee for all I knew. It did not feel 100%. Like a Guy Ritchie movie.
Okay.
So I guess I just hope that Barry's style comes through.
Then today, right now, I'm going to say to you guys that if on one side of the spectrum is what Ryan Coogler was able to bring to Black Panther, and the other side of the spectrum is what Guy Ritchie was able to bring to Aladdin, where is Barry Jenkins going to fall in this interpretation of Lion King?
I would like to think that Jenkins doesn't take this movie unless he can approach it with the same focus and respect for the continent of Africa that Ryan Coogler did with Black Panther.
I wonder if he came to them with an idea. I wonder if he had an idea and came to them.
That's what I wonder too, but like Coogler is a great example to bring up here, because Black Panther is that perfect middle ground of a director's style mixed in with the gigantic element of what a studio picture is going to be, right?
Yeah.
So like if you look at Fruitvale Station, which is an absolute masterpiece, Creed, his budgets got bigger, but what he wanted to say in each movie stayed the same.
Yeah.
Like his His through line to each film got out there. Black Panther is a $200 million Marvel film. I wouldn't necessarily say, oh, I felt Ryan Coogler's voice, but I felt like I was watching a Ryan Coogler movie.
Well, and also he had something to say. Like, it's also a love letter to a culture.
Right.
And
exactly.
I do, based on what I've read so far about, you know, and I'm very well documented about my hatred of Jon Favreau's Lion King on the show. But I will say the one thing that sort of like perked my interest is that it sort of sounds like he wants his sequel to be like a love letter to a people, to a culture, to Africa.
Okay.
And that's what intrigues me. And it, honestly, if that's the angle that he's approaching it, then that makes me go, oh, yeah, that's awesome. Cool. That's like if you're not just going to, like, if you're telling me this isn't going to be like Simba's Pride, which is Lion King 2.
1.5.
God, what am I doing?
It's not even a full sequel.
But then I'm in. Like, if that's what you're looking to do, like, the fact that I heard that and we want this to be the Godfather Part 2 of Lion King
that's
movies.
Ridiculous.
That's stop. What I sort of went. And that because they're saying that they want it to be both structure. A flashback to Mufasa's origin story, just sure. like Vito, and then also a continuation of Simba's story. But the idea of telling a love letter to Africa is what makes me go, okay, Barry Jenkins, you do you, man.
Yeah, I mean, that sounds great to me. I guess the problem is, for me, everything you just said is the movie I want to see. But are we going to get that film? And I think when Guy Ritchie was announced for Aladdin, I was like, oh, man, this is going to be like Lock, Stock, and Snatch. You know, I was expecting more of his editing, more of his tone, more of Guy Ritchie. So I think with what's the gentleman who scores Barry's movies, Nicholas Britell?
Yeah, I believe so.
A phenomenal composer. I know he did Beale Street. He did Moonlight. If I'm botching the name, I apologize. But he's an incredible composer. And I saw a tweet today that was they were talking about, because Zimmer did Lion King, right? Didn't Zimmer also do the remake or the live action? I think Zimmer was still involved, even though it was his music from the first one.
I think so.
So I think. With Barry Jenkins, and it's so funny, like, if I saw something come across my timeline that day that said, we're making a Lion King sequel prequel, and it's coming out in 2022, I would have immediately, like, rolled my eyes. But it was the Barry Jenkins part of it that really kind of hooked me. Because this guy, I don't think he's made a movie over $10 million. I don't know how much the budgets were for Beale Street or Moonlight, but they weren't expensive.
I was just looking, Beale Street, Moonlight was $4 million, according to Box Office Mojo. Moonlight was $4 million. For Beale Street, they gave him 12.
Right. So you're talking about taking on potentially, what do you think it's going to be, like $200 million project?
Probably.
Yeah. I mean, how much was the first line? I mean, if you're looking at elevations of filmmakers, I mean, Guy Ritchie's most expensive film prior to that must have been the Sherlock Holmes film. Yeah. So he actually had but if you look at Ryan Coogler, for example, Fruitvale probably cost less than $3 or $4 million. I don't know for sure.
Sure.
Creed was a step up.
Probably,
and
like
then
60,
once he
65.
Did Creed was the one that made me, oh, he could definitely do Black Panther if he could pull off Creed. I just don't, does Barry need another mid-budget film first?
I mean, maybe that's what it is. Maybe he just truly felt like he wanted to challenge himself and take on, you know, the big money, huge production type thing. I don't know. We'll see.
Do you think that they're going to have to hire writers that know how to do something other than copy paste? I know that was a tough skill on the first one.
I assume they would have to do that. Yes.
So the budget might be even more than
copy paste.
I'll just mention this because it's inspiring. Fruitvale Station cost $900,000.
Wow.
$900,000 for Fruitvale Station.
And it's a masterpiece.
And
incredible.
It's literally one of the greatest movies ever made.
Wow.
It's such a good movie. I will never forget. You know, you always remember where you are when you see a certain film. Lauren and I were at the Angelica in Fairfax, and I remember we were sitting in the bottom right of the stadium seating, and we just cried through the whole credits, the whole ending credits. We just couldn't believe what we just experienced. And I still think that might be the greatest thing Michael B. Jordan's ever done. Like, I mean, I love him in Black Panther, but that performance, like, he became Oscar.
Yeah.
He was him.
He's also great in Friday Night Lights, if you've never seen Friday Night Lights.
But Fruitvale, and I'll say, the last thing I'll say on this, I don't mean to go off on a tangent. Fruitvale was one of the few experiences I've ever had where I felt like I got to meet somebody who was no longer living. Like I felt like I felt like I actually met Oscar. I feel like I got to experience his life just for the brief period that we had in that movie. Michael B. Jordan brought him to life, and I think that was a really powerful thing.
I want to apologize to Daniel Day-Lewis if he's listening to this podcast for his Lincoln portrayal. One single tear is going down his cheek saying, Kevin, I brought that president back to life for you.
I think there are amazing actors out there, no question. I guess the point I was making is I didn't know who Oscar was before watching Fruitvale Station. Lincoln has been in my mind for years. So it was just like, this was just like, I got to meet somebody who I'd never met before and didn't know a lot about, basically.
Absolutely. Absolutely. All right, let's get to the trailer reactions to the reboot for The Craft. So Craft wasn't my time. I'm assuming you guys have seen it a bunch.
I like the album. I remember there was like an alternative rock album.
Yeah, it's so mid 90s.
Yeah, is it really?
Was it like 96? So like it's the ultimate like mid 90s.
And who is the lead girl? Not Neve Campbell, but the she was like, I thought she was gonna be a bigger star.
Yeah, she was also in End of Days with Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Yeah, it was
Balk.
I
vaguely remember her.
She had such a unique like acting face that I thought we were going to see her more often. She's the visual of that film that I remember.
Yeah.
Like, when I think back to The Craft, it's her face.
She reminds me of a Winona Ryder type almost.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I'm looking at her and her filmography and
Did she do a Sandler movie?
The Craft. After The Craft, she did Island of Dr. Moreau.
Okay.
Then she did American History X. She was in The Water Boy. There's your Sandler film. Oh,
you and I are thinking of two different people.
Okay. Almost Famous. She played Sapphire in Almost Famous.
Yeah.
So it's like she consistently worked up until now. She's in a new show called Paradise City with
Rose.
I think Axl Rose is directing it and Slash is the star.
So wait, trailer, there's a photograph of her though, isn't there? Isn't there going to be a direct connection to her? I thought one of the girls was holding a photograph of her character.
Oh, I'm sure.
Yes, in the trailer, yeah.
Okay.
There's no way she's not going to be. They're not going to come back. So does that mean Neve Campbell's going to do both Scream 5 and The Craft within The Craft has already been filmed.
Yeah, Craft's coming out.
Do you think Neve Campbell and the rest of the cast? I guarantee you they're in it. There's no way they're not in it, right?
Maybe. Yeah, probably.
Like Ghostbusters style. Like, by the way, like remember the Ghostbusters showed up in Paul Feig's movie and it was not great.
Terrible.
I actually like Paul Feig's Ghostbusters, but the way that they showed up was not. It was terrible.
Horrible.
It was awful.
Yeah, it was actually really embarrassing.
It was embarrassing. So I wonder if like Neve Campbell and the cast of The Craft are.
Hold on. In case you don't remember, Dan Aykroyd played a taxi driver who actually had to deliver the line, "I ain't afraid of no ghosts," as he drove away.
It was one of the most uncomfortable cameos I've ever seen in my entire life.
Like, awful. You know that like he had a right to look at them and go, "No, I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to say that
line."
They
asked him to do it.
And he said yes.
And he said yes.
He didn't have to say yes.
Yeah, they let him promote his vodka, probably.
Yeah, as he's taking a sip out of that skull.
That crystal head vodka that he's always plugging.
I'm the kingdom of the crystal skull.
So we're on this nostalgia cycle, and apparently we're coming around to The Craft. Does it look okay to you guys, judging on?
Yeah, I mean, like, horror is such, an ever-evolving entity.
Yeah.
And, you know, like, what horror looked like in the 70s is different than what it looked like in the 90s, and it's different than what it looks like now. And so I'm sort of curious to, like, I'm not expecting it to be the film that I grew up. If anything, I'm just sort of curious as to, like, obviously, like, horror is sort of a reflection of, like, a certain audience that's ingesting it. So, like, I remember the 90s Craft being sort of a reflection of my generation. So I'm sort of curious as to what this new Craft is going to look like, and thereby what is it going to say about sort of the younger generation that's sort of ingesting horror now.
So that line at the end of the trailer is from the original, though, right? Like, we are the weirdos. There's a lot of weirdos out here. Like, that's one of those ones. Like, even though I haven't seen the Craft, as soon as I heard them utter that line, it was like a flashback of like, oh, yeah, I remember when that line was a marketable thing.
The director of the Craft remake is like a actress who's been in like a zillion shows. Her name is Zoe Lister Jones or Zoe Lister Jones. She was in New Girl. She's like apparently.
Just crafting a tweet about Fawn Moscato from New Girl directing this movie. It's fantastic.
Yeah, exactly. That's who it is. Fawn Moscato.
A tweet?
I was crafting a tweet. What do you say? I was tweeting a tweet? What do you say? I was writing a tweet?
We're talking about the craft.
She's only directed.
Okay, I didn't mean to do that.
So she did a movie in 2017 called Band-Aid, and then this is her second feature film.
Well, let's get her on Real Blend, for God's sakes.
I'm down.
All right, so this is officially a remake, right? Officially a remake.
No,
it's a reboot.
Yeah.
Okay, so IMDb says a remake of the 1996 film The Craft.
Yeah, that's like Wikipedia. Anybody can get on there. There's a photo of an original cast member. Yeah, so it can't be a remake.
And in character from the original.
Disney just texted me to say that it's a follow-up.
The IMDb spiritual successor. In the official synopsis, like the area where you can't make edits, it says remake.
Yeah, but the IMDb isn't always right.
All right, let's move on. We'll discuss the... Well, when is it coming? Is it like this year?
October 27th.
Yeah, next month.
They're holding on to that?
It's October 27th. Well, it's going to VOD.
Oh, VOD.
It's going to be $20 to rent and $25 to own.
Yep.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
That's interesting.
Which is pocket change for Mr. $60 over here.
Gabe crossed this out, but I want to briefly mention that Bill and Ted is coming to DVD on November 10th.
He crossed it out, Sean.
He did.
Did you guys see what the Kathy Lee Gifford film is doing for release? I think this is kind of, again, I don't think this should be done for all movies, but for maybe like a smaller film, they're doing like the Fathom event bit. Yeah. One night this week on Wednesday.
Yeah.
So you can go to the theatrical experience if you want to. Then it goes to VOD Friday. I feel like, you know, a lot of these smaller films, that might be a way around the theatrical window. Maybe do like a, maybe you could even do like a two night, you know, those Fathom events they do with the opera all those things. So you just put it out in theaters, give people the opportunity if they want to pop out on a Wednesday night, 7 o'clock, and go see it, or VOD it. I don't think all movies, but.
This is marginally depressing, and then I'll move on after this, Gabe, I promise. The independent theater in South Carolina by me had to shut down again solely because of no product offer.
Yeah.
They have no movies. No new movies coming, and people are not turning out for the retro titles. So I think the Regal that's by me is still open, but this was a Redstone cinema. They had two locations in South Carolina, and they had to close down because they have no movies to show, unfortunately. So anyway, that transitions us to This Week in Movies, of which we have two Netflix films and one Amazon Prime film. Boy, do I miss movies going to theaters. Netflix, September 30th, The Boys in the Band. I don't think we've seen it. Have anyone seen it? Nothing?
I have not seen this.
No? Vampires versus the Bronx. Netflix, October 2nd. Okay, so this at least looks like an Attack the Block type thing. Mm-hmm. John Boyega's early film with aliens in London. But neither of us have seen it. None of us have seen it yet. So we'll be checking out. But The Glorias. We have seen The Glorias. And as you know, we spoke to Julie Taymor earlier this week. This is coming to Amazon Prime and Video On Demand on September 30th. Really clever way to get into this story. I'm a little bit tired of biopics. And I think that the genre needs to be rethought when people come to them. And so that's exactly what Julie Taymor does. She attacks the life of political activist, journalist, Gloria Steinem. It's one of those situations where there's so many stories that you could tell about her career and her life. This film literally covers 80 years of her life, but casts four different actresses to play her at different times and has them interact with each other throughout the movie, which alone was a fascinating concept, giving them the ability to comment to each other about how she's feeling in her life. She uses something called, God, I'm going to blank on the name of the, it's like the bus through time or the bus lost in time. So everything is shot with Julie Taymor traditional colors, really vibrant colors, real vibrant pictures. For people who don't know Julie Taymor, for God's sakes, she got the, was it the Pulitzer or the Tony for directing The Lion King?
Probably the Tony.
The Tony? Huge.
She won
awards.
The Tony for Best Directing for Lion King.
She brought that Lion King vision to the stage.
If you've never seen it, I feel like it sounds so cliche to say you like The Lion King on stage, but it deserves every word of acclaim it's ever received.
It's unbelievable. It's so visionary. And I know that it's been around forever, so people have sort of taken it for granted. But when she first came out with it, it was unbelievable.
Yeah.
She talked a lot about Across the Universe in our interview with her. It's a fantastic
adaptation. Which is one of the best movie soundtracks of all time. Like I know it sounds like blasphemous to say like, oh, I like someone else's version of a Beatles song more. Yeah. And I'm not saying that that's necessarily the case.
Yeah.
But there are some incredible alternatives to some of their Evan Rachel Wood singing Blackbird.
Yes.
If you've never, like, there are some truly incredible covers of Beatles songs in Across the Universe.
So throughout the Glorias, while she's shooting most of Gloria Steinem's life in these vibrant colors and popping scenes, she'll return the actresses to this bus that's traveling through Gloria Steinem's life, theoretically. And that's where the four of them can sort of converse about how things are going. But she shoots that in black and white. And it's such a standout as opposed to everything else that you're watching. And it makes amazing parallels to what's going on in our modern society and things that people are still fighting for, inequalities that people are fighting for. And to that point, that's why she brought up in the interview how she fought really hard to get it out on streaming service before the election happened. Unlike Borat 2, she also wants to make a statement before the election happens. That's the only thing they have in common. So check out The Glorias when it comes to Amazon Prime and VOD. Alicia Vikander is phenomenal in it. She does most of the heavy lifting in it. She plays that 30 to 50 probably age before handing the baton off to Julianne Moore. And so any movie where Alicia Vikander is passing the baton to Julianne Moore is obviously well worth your time. And The Glorias is certainly one of those films. So that brings us to this week's blend game. And speaking of phenomenal collaborators on film, we're going to be discussing director of photography and noted cinematographer Michael Chapman, who we lost recently. Big time collaborator of the early days of Martin Scorsese and just an unbelievable filmography over the years. You know, we've been doing directors, sometimes we do actors, but every once in a while, someone like Michael Chapman comes around, contributes to some incredible films. And so we're going to be singling out our favorite film that he worked on. So that's difficult because, like, he's done some phenomenal work, Gabe, I'm saying this to you, in films that I might not necessarily say are like my favorite films. So that makes this a bit of a challenge from that perspective. Yes? No?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, it's about his work. If there's something that you say like that cinematography speaks to me more, then I say go with that because we're celebrating him. But if there's, you know, it's a movie that he helped make that you loved, he's a part of that as well. The big part of it.
Kev, I'll start with you then. Where did you go when you were celebrating the life and times of Michael Chapman?
Well, it's interesting because I feel like the obvious ones to go to are like Taxi Driver or like a Raging Bull. And
sure,
you know, the black and white in Raging Bull is just outstanding. It looks incredible still to this day. But if we're talking about favorite movies that this person's been involved in, like the one I've seen the most on his list of filmography is Kindergarten Cop. and I know that sounds strange to bring that up because we're a film podcast. We discuss cinematography all the time and all these amazing shots. I mean, Taxi Driver and Raging Bull are, I feel like those are just auto. Those are automatically just amazing films.
Yeah, but I can't
films.
Pick them for favorite. Like Taxi Driver, it's amazing, but I'd never just pop it on to pass the time.
I'm with
Wait. What are we doing? We're picking his favorite work. I'm not saying Gary Oldman's
favorite movie that he's
his
done.
Work. His work.
We're celebrating a cinematographer. That's the emphasis on cinematography.
For sure. You can,
yeah. Like I'm not saying that. I didn't say that Hannibal is my favorite movie that Gary Oldman's ever been in. It's just my favorite performance of his.
Okay. Fair enough. Yeah. I see what you're
first
saying.
Time on the show.
Well, Kev, keep going with your pick, though.
Love Kindergarten Cop. Yeah, thank you. I love Kindergarten Cop. I think it's an incredible film. I think it's underrated. I mean, I think people don't really think about it from a cinematography standpoint, but I do think it's just a really well-told story. And I think Ivan Reitman did a phenomenal job with that movie. And I don't know. For me, looking at this list, that's just the one that jumped out at me. I mean, you can go through Primal Fear, Space Jam. I mean, the guy's directed or DP'd some of the greatest movies in the history of cinema. Do I think that Raging Bull is not as good as Kindergarten Cop? No, that's not what I'm saying. If I'm looking at his list and I'm looking for the film that I would put on, my favorite movie that he's been involved in that list would be Kindergarten Cop, just from a strictly nostalgic realm.
Jake, your pick is?
I'm going to pick based on his cinematography.
Are you picking best or favorite?
My favorite work of his cinematography, because he's a cinematographer.
Yes.
I'm going with Taxi Driver.
Okay.
And the reason I say that is just because, like, I never knew that New York. Like, my New York has always been Disneyfied. You know, you get your family and you walk around Times Square and you got Broadway all over the place and you got the Lion King billboard. Like, that's the New York that I knew growing up. But I felt like what he captured And the way he captured the New York of that era kind of shows this like city rotting from the inside, and but also reflect puts Travis Bickle in the frame, and that it also kind of shows that he's a man, like New York is a city rotting from the inside. He's kind of like a man rotting from the inside, and just the way that he captures just the light, the way that he shoots what could be, you know, a very, you know, we've seen a thousand different ways or that the people have shot, you know, the taxi sort of like, you know, sequence, you know, people in cars and someone driving the car, but just the way that, and the way that he does it, even with Scorsese sitting in the backseat, just the way that he films that, I just think it's both beautiful and haunting and dirty all at the same time. And really captures a city that has been photographed 10 billion times in cinema, but he does it unlike, I think, any other movie that ever has captured the city of New York. So I choose Taxi Driver because of his work as a cinematographer, which is what he is.
My pick is going to split the line. Gabe, I'm pivoting away from the one that I told you. And I'm going to choose Doc Hollywood. Because again, when I looked at his filmography, Doc Hollywood stands out to me for this reason. I grew up in New York, not quite the Taxi Driver in New York that you're discussing, Jake, but not that far off from it. I was at least there during the 70s and 80s when it wasn't, you know, quite as Disney-fied as it is. And I remember watching Doc Hollywood and having a very visceral reaction to the way that he shoots small town South, the small town South. And I think that that's a huge part of the reason why I live in North Carolina now, that I felt a very strong pull toward the South Carolina town that Michael J. Fox lands himself in. I looked around at New York and the hustle and bustle and everything that comes with New York. And I thought, like, that's a better lifestyle. I would much rather be part of that sort of country, slower atmosphere. And I realized looking at the filmography of Michael Chapman, not even knowing that I didn't even know that he DP'd on that movie. But I can remember clear as a bell how much that movie impacted me and made me think this is going to be sound really strange, too. Doc Hollywood and one other film made me feel like, oh, my God, I can't wait to go down and see the South.
Oh, brother?
No. Before this is Sleeping with the Enemy. Julia Roberts escaping from her predatory husband and ends up in like a rural bumpkin South Carolina town. I actually think it was the Midwest, but they shot it in Aiken, South Carolina. And I remember watching those scenes and just thinking, that looks so inviting. That looks so warm and comfortable and homey. And I can't wait to go down and coming down to North Carolina after being in DC for several years. That's what we found. That we found that environment of, if you're going to the grocery store, you better get used to having a conversation with people who are waiting on you, who are cutting your sandwich meats or checking you out. Like, they're going to ask you how you are today and you better have an answer, because, or if you're going to a restaurant, you know, like, you're not getting your food right away. It's going to take plenty of time because you're going to have multiple conversations with all the people through you. And it's just, you slow down because that's the mood that permeates this area. And Doc Hollywood is a movie that introduced me to that concept. And I'm going to credit Michael Chapman for the way that he shot rural South Carolina. Which, again, makes no sense, because why Michael J. Fox was going from New York to Beverly Hills and pit stopped in South Carolina is just a classic Los Angeles screenwriter having no idea how anything happens, but is like,
having no access to a map.
We have to get him to South Carolina somehow. And the way that he detours off the road is fucking cows in the middle of the road. God, it's so many bad Southern stereotypes, but works really, really well.
Mentioned, and this is a, speaking of detours, you mentioned just like things that happen in the South that don't happen anywhere else. You know, I'm from even before I moved to the burbs of Houston, I'm from a very small town, and I brought one of my buddies there, I don't know, a couple of years ago, and he noticed something that to me, and I'm curious as to if they do it where you're at, Sean, where when you drive by someone, you just kind of wave.
Oh, all the time.
And I drove by a few people, and, you know, we did the wave, and my buddy goes, "Do you know all those people?"
Yeah.
And I go, "No, you just, you know," he goes, Why do all of you wave at each other? And I was like, it's just what you do. You just, when someone drives by, you wave at them.
When we're walking Squirty every single night, we walk Squirt after dinner. And if anyone is driving through our neighborhood, when you pass them, you just give a wave.
Yeah. Give them the wave.
Hey, how you doing? Yeah. Hey. Oh, no, that's obviously standard around here. And yes, would be very strange to somebody outside of the South.
Yeah.
I would imagine. All right. Audience picks. Randy Buss, Evan Rook, and several others chose The Fugitive. Now, I don't imagine that they chose The Fugitive because of his cinematography in it.
Right.
I think they chose The Fugitive because they like The Fugitive.
Exactly.
They don't host the show.
Aiden
Erdahl. They're playing the game based on how we thought the game was played. We've had this
discussion 1,000 times.
Well, we had it 1,001. Aiden Erdahl said Taxi Driver. Stephanie DeLise went with my previous pick, which was The Lost Boys. His work on Lost Boys is unbelievably good. And again, I didn't even know he shot it until I looked at it. So for next week, since we're heading into October, last October we did something where we had a theme all the way throughout. And it was horror-type movies and horror themes that we branched off with. And we're going to continue that going into this October as we get ready for Jake to drop the monster of all packages. We can talk about it, right? You've teased
yeah,
it, haven't
course.
We? Yeah? Yeah. Jake has yeah. a great package that he's putting together for Fox 32 on on-screen monsters. And we will have plenty more to share with that as it comes together. So for next week, you can reach out on Twitter using hashtag Haunted House Blend. So it's a movie that has to do with a haunted house. So let us know your pick using that hashtag or sending us an email to realblend@cinemablend.com. And as you know, every single week, you can also use that email to send us a review. And this week's review comes to us from Alexis DeMeza that says, "The GOAT in podcasting," and says, "Very rarely are films, books, albums, and artwork pieces truly appreciated in their time. In many instances, they are later perceived to be the greatest depictions of their kind, usually at a much later stage. Real Blend is an example of a podcast that at this moment may not be on everyone's radar. However, I can most certainly guarantee that it will go down as not just a great and fascinating film television podcast, but one of the greatest podcasts to ever consume data streaming metrics during the podcast stance that we live in." Okay, let's stop for just 1 second and process that. Someone actually wrote that. Like, that, we don't have to believe that that's true.
I'm not convinced that it's not one of you.
It's absolutely not one. It wasn't me. It could be Kev's mom.
I can't spell that.
That's amazing that anyone would even think that. Let alone write in a review. And then I go on to say, "My only regret is that the rating metric contains me to just a 5-star rating, for I would easily give you gentlemen 5 lifetimes worth of gratitude and appreciation. Sean, Jake, Kevin, Kevin's mom, and Gabe, thank you all for providing me with an escape and for letting me into your little film world. Dunkirk with all exclamation points." That is from Alexis DeMeza. Turn off Alexa. Stop turning. My Alexa keeps turning on every single time.
Dude, I just watched that movie I was telling you about, Save Yourselves. There's a whole sequence where they talk to Alexa, and it kept setting off my Alexa last night. You know, I was just thinking, Kevin hasn't admitted to us that his mom's written any reviews in a while. Should we be hurt by that? Is she just not really digging the show anymore, or she's given up writing reviews, or?
Well, yeah, she writes all the reviews still.
Still? Every single one of them?
Yeah.
Well, that was a very nice one. Can you please send her our love? That one really hit home. She might want to dial back the colorful language a little bit because...
Well, she's been taking, what Kevin's not telling us, she's been taking creative writing classes, and she's working them out on these reviews.
All right, our next premium episode is going to be the first horror movies that we can remember seeing and our reactions to... the film genre. So if you want to subscribe to the Real Blend Premium, there is a link in the description for this podcast. And also, if you're watching us on the YouTube, it is part of the description on the YouTube channel. So come join us over in Premium World when you guys get a chance. In the meantime, follow us on social media at Jake's Takes, at Kevin McCarthy TV, and at Sean_O'Connell. Follow the show at Real Blend, and we'll be back next week. Tara, a good friend of ours, wants me to keep doing the Bane voice at the end of each episode, but I have to work on it. I don't have it down pat. So I'll just end this episode with the game.